Hi, I'm Phil Hendry. This is my life story with as much detail as I can think of for the next 30 minutes. I was born September 1st, 1952 in Pasadena, California at St. Luke's Hospital. I weighed 8 pounds and some ounces. I don't know how many. I think 16 ounces, but isn't 16 ounces a pound? So it'd be 8 pounds and something less than that. Nonetheless, I was born at St. Luke's Hospital to Marjorie Alice Hendry, Crow, and my father, Herbert Lionel Hendry, and they were recently transplanted from Canada. They became American citizens several years after my birth, and my dad worked at that time for National Cash Register Company as a salesman. So home I come from the hospital, and I was baptized a week later at Holy Angels. I don't know where the fuck I was baptized. No, I'm kidding. I think I was baptized at Holy Angels Church, even though, because Annunciation's church wasn't built yet, something like that. And I was given the name Klaus von Kugel. Oh, no, that's a confirmation. That's right. You don't get a name when you're baptized as a Catholic. You're just baptized. And I was baptized by, I don't know who I was baptized by. I do know that my godfather, I very proudly say this, my godfather, was a United States congressman. His name escaped me. I think it was Walton. And they were very close friends of my mother and father. And he did eventually become a U.S. House of Representatives congressperson from California. But I don't know. Forgive me, sir, if you are still with us. And forgive me, his family, if you're listening. I don't remember the gentleman's name. I probably should have looked that up. But it's just, this is, as I say, extemporaneous off the top of my head. Nonetheless, there I was. Growing up, one of my earliest memories was trying to stand on my head on the front lawn of our house. I remember being fascinated by ants going up the side of this tree that had this kind of flaky bark. And I remember being fascinated by the dust coming through a mail slot. In those days, the mail slots were in the doors of houses, and maybe they still have those. And I thought that was interesting, the way the sunlight would flow in and you could see the dust in the sunlight. Other things I remember trying to do is pick up water in this little temporary, you know, one of those little play pools my folks had in the backyard, and being scared to death of something that looked like a big green praying mantis on my arm. And it was just sitting there on my arm, and I screamed so loud my father came running into the backyard thinking that I was being attacked by a grizzly bear or something, and it was just me scared of this insect on my arm. Those were the earliest memories I had. Oh, yeah, we tickled a kid in the neighborhood so much that he shit his pants. I remember that because I felt bad about it at the time. And that's the last time we ever did anything like that. It was very sadistic. We knew the kids, though. They were two brothers that we played with across the street. Their mother was a Christian Scientist. And I only say that, and I could be wrong, and please don't take this as being critical of the religion at all, because it's not. I may be wrong in remembering the religion of the family, but I do recall sitting on the driveway there on my tricycle or whatever passed for the bicycle that I was wearing, that I was riding at that time, although I might have been wearing it. Maybe I was wearing it after the mother heard what I said. But nonetheless, I was talking to this kid friend of mine whose brother we had tickled to the point where he shit his pants. And I said something about the devil, because I was raised Catholic, so the devil was real. And through the window in the kitchen, the mother said to me, "Philip Hendry, we teach our children there is no devil." And I remember feeling really humiliated and put down, and I felt terrible. And I think I said something like, "I'm very sorry, ma'am," and just, you know, rolled off on my tricycle. And but that was kind of how I got the vibe that these cats were, you know, they were great guys. I like the guys themselves, but, you know, they're... Mom was sort of like that kind of a person. There was also a father of one of the little girls we played with. He had a train set in the garage, really a great train set, one of these train sets that you wanted to have when you saw it. It had all the little towns and villages, and it had mountains and stuff, and the Super Chief train. And he would, you know, turn this thing on weekends. The kids would come over and watch this train set. So that was pretty cool. And the kid up the street, this kid named Roddy, we were scared of him because he would throw rocks at you as you rolled your bicycle by the house. I never wanted to ride my bike that far up the street because this Roddy kid was just a real piece of shit kid. I often wonder now in later years, you know, if he was abused or he was beaten badly by a father or mother. I mean, you'd have to be. If you're that kind of a sadistic, mean kid, there must be something going on in the house, right? Now, if I'm not mistaken, and I know you're going to hate me saying this because I'm not just saying this gratuitously, I believe that kid grew up to become an L.A. police officer. I swear, I'm not kidding. because I did meet him later in life. The name was the same, and he was from the same general neighborhood. So I think this was the same kid that eventually became a cop. But what I'm saying is I used to like ride my bike up the street, and he'd throw stuff at you, he'd yell at you, and he'd threaten you. And I was always scared to ride my bike up that, you know, that far up the street. Eventually, I got old enough to go to kindergarten, and they enrolled me at Camino Grove Kindergarten. And our teacher was Miss Elaine, or Miss Ellen. That was it, Miss Ellen. She was a nice lady. And we did things like literally made clay rabbits, and we took our naps in those little nap mats. And that was kindergarten. And it was a whole, you know, year of going on the bus to kindergarten, playing with whatever they gave us to play with. And also, at the end, we graduated from kindergarten in this rather, I would say, you know, elaborate graduation ceremony. We were little five-year-olds, but they had us do the hukilau, which was you put leis, Hawaiian leis around your neck, and did this hukilau dance. And actually, film survives of that. If you go on the website, philhendryshow.com, you can see me doing the hukilau at the age of five. It was also that year, in fact, that I met my grandmother on my father's side, meaning my father's real mother. Now, understand that I grew up knowing of James and Mary Hendry. Those were the parents that my father spoke of, and those were the parents that he considered his parents. But my dad was, in fact, adopted. He didn't know who his real father was. He did know who his real mother was because he was taken to visit her frequently as a boy, and then found out as an adult that this woman that he was taken to visit was in fact his mother and not just some friend of Mary Hendry, the woman he believed to be his mother. She was his real mother. Her name was Agnes. I don't know her last name, but he would take a train to Albany, New York with his mom, you know, his adopted mother. And then eventually found out, I think, when he was an adult, after he came back from overseas, that that was really his mother, this woman, Agnes. So in 1956, I know that year, why, I don't know, 56 or 57. It had to be 57 because I was a kindergartner. And I remember this lady, Agnes, meeting me as I got off the bus. So I guess I was a five-year-old. I know it wasn't first grade. And she was great. I thought she was the greatest lady in the world. She was just a nice lady. She was kind. She told us stories. She liked to play. She was terrific. So I remember her as being this really great person who came to visit us. And I would ask my mom, who is that? Who is this Agnes? She'd say, she's a friend of your mother's. I mean, she's a friend of your father's. If my mother said it was a friend of your mother's, then I'd wonder who's my mother then? If you're the one telling me this, that would have been complicated. But no, she'd say, that's a friend of your father's. And I'd say, okay, it's a friend of mine. When you're 4 or 5 years old, you don't question these things. It's, yeah, dad's friend came to visit him, some older woman from wherever. It was only later on in my life that I found out that that was indeed my real grandmother, my father's real mother, and he did not treat her kindly. He told her basically to get lost. My father excused that by saying to me, well, she asked for money. By the way, it was during this period of time that I also met another relative of my father's. I think it was a relative of my father's. Her name was Alice. Again, I only knew these women by their first names, Alice. And I think she was a cousin of my real grandmother, this Agnes woman that my father said get lost to. I think Alice might have been a cousin to that woman, or she was a cousin to my dad. I don't know. All I know is that she was another really cool old lady that came to visit. Oh, Alice is coming. And we say, oh, yeah, Alice, bitchin', Alice is coming. Who she was, we don't know. She was just a friend. But Alice would come. She worked at the Green Hotel in Pasadena and always had these great stories about Jack Benny and Red Skelton coming into the luggage shop that she worked at and how funny they were and what wonderful guys they were. Oh, Red Skelton came in and he did this and that, and Jack Benny came in and he did something else. And we'd just be really, you know, and while she's telling these stories, she always brought over a bag of C's lollipops. You know those suckers you get from C's? They were either caramel or they were chocolate. She always brought over a bag each. And so there we are eating these lollipops and listening to some horseshit that Alice was telling us about Red Skelton, Jack Benny, or Bob Hope. But we swallowed it, and I have no reason to doubt it. I mean, I'm sure she did meet these people. And it was that day forward, from that era forward, that Agnes was in our lives until, I would say, my early teens. And then I believe she died. She left me a little bit of money. She left me enough money to buy a car. I remember that. I was just back from Florida. I was 22, and I think that's when Agnes died. And I bought myself a car. My brother got some money. All of the kids got some money. My mother got some money. My dad didn't get a dime. She cut him out because he wound up divorcing my mother, but that's a story for a later point. All right, moving on with the biography here of me, Phil Hendry, or the autobiography. I just belched, pardon me. So I went to kindergarten. Then after kindergarten, I believe that summer before I went into first grade was the year, the momentous year that we took a car drive all the way across the country to Toronto, Canada, to visit for the very first time in my life to meet my grandparents. That would be my mom's adopted mother and father. That's a whole other story. My mother's parents also died when she was young. Her father, in fact, was run off by her stepfather, who was a Toronto cop. This is the truth that was hid from me and the rest of my siblings for so many years. My grandfather on my mother's side, my actual blood grandfather, was apparently a jolly fellow who liked to, you know, have a couple of belts. And so was my grandmother on my mother's side. She played the piano at the local tavern where she met my real grandfather. Well, these two people eventually disappeared from my mom's life. In the case of her father, run off, literally told to get lost by her new stepfather, Frank Crow, a police officer in Toronto. And in those days, I guess you could legally do that. There was anything that a man could do. Her mother, who Frank married, died of rheumatic fever when my mom was 9. So by the time I met what passed for my grandparents, and they were nice people, these were my mother's step-parents who adopted her, or if you will, they were her adopted parents. I don't know. Adopted her and my aunt, Gladdy. And these are the people that I met, along with my uncle George and my aunt Gladdy and my cousins Franny and Elaine and Paul. And I also saw my uncle Harry and my aunt Gladys, my great aunt Gladys, who was, I think, yeah, on my mom's side. I met all these people when we took this car ride back to Toronto in the summer of 1957, when I was about to turn 5. No, in the summer of 58, when I was about to turn 6. That's it. I had been 5, or I was then 5, and I was about to become 6. So off we go across the country. What I remember about that, I remember it as being a blast. It's also where I fell in love with radio, because I would listen to the radio overnight as my father was driving. My dad and I were the only ones awake in the car. And if you can imagine this is my dad and my mom with 4 kids in the backseat of a 56 Mercury two-tone. Not that the two-tone made it any worse, but that's pretty trippy. I don't know. That's patience, man. I don't know how they did it, but they kept 4 kids. My father gave all the credit to my mom in later years, saying that she kept you kids quiet and entertained through that whole trip, and she was a real saint, and so on and so forth. A lot of good stuff my dad said about my mom that he never really said prior to that in life. But hey, you know, better late than never. So I remember falling in love listening to the radio, or falling in love with listening to the radio. I didn't fall. I was 5. There was my dad and I, and I remember stopping at different motels. That, to me, was the greatest thing in the world, because we could go swimming, and we also got to see which was the Coke machine and where was the candy machine, you know, and it was all really super exciting. And then we saw things that in later years I look back on, I realized how sad it was, but at one place it was a store or something where a little Indian boy was doing a war dance, or one of those dances. He was wearing a full headdress and was dancing some kind of native dance for us as his father beat a drum, and people tossed money. I don't know if we were in an actual Indian reservation. I don't know where we were, but we were somewhere in Wyoming. That's what I recall. On we traveled during this cross-country trip. The only other thing memorable about the trip to Canada as opposed to the trip home, because I can't tell you the difference between the either trip, just a bunch of really fun motels with really great Coke machines and, you know, and drinks like orange soda and stuff like that. But I remember going under the Detroit River on our way into Canada. So I guess my father decided entering Canada at Detroit into Windsor was the way they would go, as opposed to, I don't know, Buffalo or someplace on into Toronto where my relatives live. But nonetheless, that's where we did. And going under the Detroit River, I was scared to death. My old man thought it was funny to say, "We're going under a river, better watch out, you know, like maybe it's going to collapse on us." And I remember crying, being petrified, looking at the moisture on the walls of the of this tunnel that went under the, I guess the Detroit River, is that the one? I don't know. And thinking, my dad's right. And my dad would say, see, look, the river's leaking. And my mom said later that was very sadistic of him, and I realized now she was right. I don't know why my dad got a kick out of that, but it scared the shit out of me. But nonetheless, we made our way across to the border crossing into Canada, and I remember the Canadian officers was these very stern-looking guys with those hats, you know, those ice cream man hats staring at you, and, oh, yeah, you American citizens, really? Coming in, what do you want in Canada? My father answering all these questions. We're like, yeah, hi, sir. And off we went into Canada and spent really a fantastic, I guess, week, 2 weeks. I have no idea how long we were there. But my memories of that were walking along the boardwalk of Lake Ontario, driving with my grandfather around the city of Toronto and smelling this area of Toronto that smelled like peanuts. And I think somebody told me later on, yeah, there was like a Planters factory or something around there. And my grandfather was a lot of fun. He was a big, jolly guy, a retired police officer. I saw pictures of him as a cop. He looked like a burly SOB. And my grandmother was a load of fun. We stayed at my grandparents' house. I had Marianne and I, my kid sister and I shared a bedroom upstairs, and they had a pretty good sized house on Winneva Avenue. When I went back to Toronto in 2011, I actually took a walk down that street with my cousins, and there was the house exactly as I remembered it, no different. In fact, that section of Toronto, the eastern part of East Queen Street, had not changed all that much. The other memory I have is going to my Uncle Harry and Aunt Gladys' apartment, which was over a store on Queen Street, watching the TV and watching it get scrambled, watching static scramble the screen every time a electric trolley car went by outside. And then, like I say, walking down to Lake Ontario and listening to my brother tell some long, tall, ridiculous story about, you know, facing off some motorcycle gang down in some part of Toronto, which I didn't believe. But nonetheless, even I didn't believe that, and I was 5 years old. It was just some load of horse dung that Dara was making up. And like that, I think that's it. And then we took off, came back from Canada, came back to the United States, and then it was the time for first grade, which was at Annunciation School there in Arcadia down Longdon Road. My teacher was Sister Ascension, and I remember being really nervous and scared the first couple of days I was there, and I think I spit up my sandwich into some wax paper, and Sister Ascension, who was this very elderly nun. I mean, you can imagine, this is a woman who probably should have been retired and just sitting in a chair someplace reading comic books or, I don't know, whatever, you know, whatever she wanted to do. And instead, they had her teaching this first grade class. It probably was very irritating to her and not anything she really looked forward to doing. Or maybe she dug it. I don't know. But nonetheless, she looked moderately irritated that I had puked up into my sandwich into this wax paper, and she had to deal with it. I was kind of a little bit of a mama's boy at that particular point in my life. I hated going to school because I didn't like the idea of leaving home and going off to this strange place. But gradually, you know, eventually I kind of got with the program. And one time I was supposed to wait for my mom to pick me up. And my older sister, Joanne, was going to school at Annunciation, too. She was there, I don't know, 4 years beyond me. So she was a 10-year-old, 10, 11, 12-year-old. And usually Joanne and I would wait for my mom to pick us up. But for some reason, my mom was supposed to pick me up early that day. Or we got out early. That was it. We got out of school early, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand how that was supposed to work. So apparently my mom didn't get the word, or my older sister didn't know, and I didn't. I just wandered out there and stood like a jackass waiting for someone to pick me up, even though it was like 2 hours too early, so she was not going to get there. And I thought, well, my mom's not going to get here. So at the age of six, I walked all the way down Longdon. It wasn't really that hard to find. You go all the way down Longdon to 7th Avenue, and I walked home. I was a little six-year-old. There are times, sometimes you're driving along, you see a little tiny kid walking down the street, you'll think, I guess the kid knows where he's going, right? Does that ever happen to you? I've seen that. And little do we know, maybe the kid's just off wandering for no reason. I don't know, but that's what I was doing. And nobody bothered me or anything, and I walked all the way from, I would say it was a good trip of at least a mile, if not more, probably more than a mile, maybe 2 miles, all the way down Longdon between my house and Annunciation School, but I walked it and turned the corner and up the street I went. And as I walked into the house, my mom was ironing and looked at me like I had just landed from Mars, something along the lines of, what are you doing here? And I said, well, they let us out of school. She goes, oh, well, the school called, but I don't know. She had a good reason why she wasn't there. But there I was, and I guess, and then, of course, she had to get in the car and go get my sister. So I don't know why I remember that. That was one instance. The other time I remembered, this was before school. I remember the L.A. County Sheriff showing up at the door with my brother, Dara, and a friend of his. They'd been shooting BB guns off in a rock quarry over in down below Longdon off of Peck Road in Monrovia, this town next to Arcadia, my hometown. And all I remember about this L.A. sheriff was this gigantic boot. In other words, I was so high, the boot was at least as tall as me, if not taller. So this guy's boot was as big as me. And I looked up, and it was this big cop. And the other thing I can remember was the radio cackling in his car, sitting out on the street, all that radio call stuff. And there's Dara looking very chagrined and recalcitrant. And all those other words. And, you know, he was caught red-handed with a BB gun. They were shooting rocks or something, or tin cans. And this cop picked him up and brought him over. He was an L.A. sheriff, which tells me that we were living in a... Well, maybe it could have been... We had Arcadia Police. In fact, the Arcadia... The city that I grew up in, Arcadia, California, had a police department for from the early 60s on, at least. I think before that, but for some reason, maybe it's because this was an unincorporated part of L.A. County where they found my brother. This guy came and got him. All right, but my brother, by the way, passed on in 2016, so he's probably looking down from where he is on high, laughing and going, that's a great story. So now we move on. One other interesting story from that era has to do with me wandering off, and this time I was at home. It was a very rainy season, a rainy day. It was raining, so it used to rain a lot in the wintertime in California. It doesn't anymore. It hasn't for many years, but back then the winter was very rainy, and there were flood control canals in LA County that had not been turned into actually concrete washes. Today you see them, and they are concrete channels. They have been perfectly sculpted and built, and the sides have been cemented, and they're directioned, and they're beautifully done. In those days, they were just basically culverts. They were ditches, big ditches dug, and the water would flow down these ditches, and cars, during the rainy season, literally had to drive through them. And if it was really a torrent of water, these cars needed help. And on this particular day, there was a group of high school boys. I'd say they were in their 15, 16, 17-year-old range, and they were guiding cars through this flood water. I don't know how they were doing that, telling them, okay, it's good to go now, the water's slowed down, or, you know, let us maybe block this water off. I don't know what the hell they were doing, but some of the kids, the little kids in the neighborhood, said, hey, we got to go down and watch and see what these guys are doing. So I naturally went down there, and I followed these other kids and stood there watching these bigger kids helping these people. And I guess I got too close, because one of the kids literally picked me up and sat me on a wall to get me out of the way. And I sat and I watched this. Well, unbeknownst to me, I wasn't thinking about it. My parents are wondering, where the hell is our kid? We got a 5-year-old, 4-year-old kid, and he's gone. And so my father got in the car and drove down the street, and maybe he heard from some of the neighbors where his son Philip was, because there I was sitting on this wall looking at these big kids helping these cars get through this floodwater. I don't remember much of what he said. I know he was pissed. He was very pissed. He might have even, you know, spanked me or whatever happened, but that stuck in my mind. A, for the what the hell was I thinking? B, how pissed off my father was, and finally C, what the hell was I thinking? And then the only other story from that period of time, which I forgot all about. This is again preschool. I was playing with a car on the living room floor, and I ran my eyebrow just above my eye into the corner of a coffee table. It could have been my eyeball. I mean, you know, so I consider myself very lucky. But it split open that part of my above the eye and the eyebrow. It split it open, pouring blood. And my folks, I remember panicking, lifting me up and putting me in the car. The only other memory I have is of staring straight up at the roof of the car between my parents as they were speeding me onto the emergency clinic. And then I remember laying on the table there And the doctor looking down and going, well, let's just see if we can't get these little germs out. You know, saying something like that as he was stitching my eye up. And it was all good. Home I went. So first grade, that was my encounter with first grade. The other thing I learned to do in first grade was play marbles. I don't know if kids do that anymore. Probably not. But it was something we did, at least in the first grade. We shot marbles. There were bowlers. There were cat's eyes. To this day, I can't tell you how you play marbles or what how you score in that game or anything, but that's what I did. Kids traded marbles. And I guess that's what, you know, I lost my marbles meant you lost everything of value. I don't see how that means you're going nuts, though. But nonetheless, that was that was first grade. And then on to second grade. But what happened was my parents decided to move. My father had a pretty good year, I guess, made some money, and it was time to leave kind of the lower section of Arcadia. It was a nice part of Arcadia. It was a beautiful part of Arcadia, but he wanted to move above Colorado Boulevard. He wanted to move above Huntington Drive, behind Santa Anita Racetrack, up in the upper echelon area up there. I don't know why that would be considered that, but nonetheless, my folks bought a house in Arcadia behind Santa Anita Racetrack from this very nice couple. The Sharks, I think was their name, that they'd owned this house since whenever, the early 50s, late 40s or something, and they bought this house from them, and we moved in. And my brother, my sisters, and I, my mom and dad, into this very nice house that my father then set about doing improvements, connecting this little rear house that Dara and I, my brother and I, slept in. I guess it was a maid's quarters. They actually connected that to the house. And then one morning, a really cool morning, I woke up, and this was the fall, so it was well before the summer, and it was, I think it was the fall that we moved in. I hear a tractor coming down the side of the house, and then I hear this tractor going to work in our backyard, and I look out, and this dude is digging a hole for a swimming pool, and that was about the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And for the next several months, maybe not months, for the next several weeks, because eventually when I got to be a young man, I worked for a pool building company, as a matter of fact. And it only takes really a few weeks. I saw this cat digging this hole, and then we watched them put the gunite in, the cement shell that forms the base there of the steel, ran in the plumbing, all that jazz, you know, put on the coping, put in the enamel, poured the pool deck. Put in, and of course, you're asking your father every day, when can we swim in it? When can we swim in it? Until eventually, and one of the things I did remember about the day that they were building this pool, that they were digging the hole, I should say, I walked out there as any self-respecting seven-year-old kid would. At this time, I was now seven. And I looked through the kitchen window, and there was my dad sitting at the kitchen table throwing back shots. I mean, he was having drinks. At 9 o'clock in the morning, this cat's having drinks. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're laughing about this stuff. But I kind of suspected at the time what was up with him. And I asked him years later. He said, I was trying to figure out how I was going to pay for it. Now, I don't really believe that was the case. I knew my dad was pretty bad with money. But I don't think he was so stupid that he decided to dig a swimming pool not knowing how he was going to pay for it. I think he was probably, in his own way, partying or celebrating or having a good time. That, look at this, I'm putting a pool in. Ha, ha, ha. But nonetheless, I remember it as a kind of a fun day watching these guys all day long. When you're a kid, watching cats dig a hole in your backyard is about as good as it gets, especially if it's a tractor, you know, what big, like a backhoe or something like that. And watching this hole get dug. And this pool was cool. I don't know who designed it or why they decided. Today, you will not find a swimming pool that's much deeper than 5 feet. This was 7 feet deep. Oh, no, I take that. It was 9 feet deep. This had a deep end of 9 feet. The reason being that in those days, pardon me, that was the chair, but you'll never believe it. In those days, it was still legal to have a springboard, not just a diving board, but we had a springboard. And you do not want to have a springboard unless you got a whole lot of water you're going to dive into. And this sucker was 9 feet deep. And we did a lot of diving off that pool, off of that springboard. To this day, I actually know how to dive off a springboard. Not from, you know, 20 feet up, don't get me wrong, but I can, you know, do a dive into a pool. And it's a beautiful thing. So that was a trip, man. And that whole winter on into spring, as this pool was being created, eventually we were told, yes, it's now ready to swim. And naturally, it was still springtime, still very, very cold. Did we care? No, we didn't. In we went. That was my second grade year. Mrs. Mack at Holy Angels School. Not a whole lot in terms of any real memory, although I did go through this period in the third grade where I made up members of my family. We were at times asked to stand up and tell stories relative to whatever it was we were talking about in class. This was third grade. I would have been 8 years old. And I told these long yarns about having a brother who fought in World War II and fell off a cliff and defeated the Japanese. This was nutty stuff. And I wondered often what the teacher must have been thinking listening to this stuff. She must have said something to my mom along the lines of, I didn't know you had a son that died in World War II, or your son Philip is a real wow, keep an eye on that one, or isn't he a fun little storyteller? I don't know what was said, but I created all kinds of bullshit. And one of the things that I had a problem with, one of the things that hung me up, I was in a Catholic school, and I guess you can have whatever beliefs you have about Catholics, but it is true, we do have large families. A lot of Catholics do. Now, I came from a family with four kids. Now, that's big enough. But in my school, that was nothing compared to some of these kids. They had 5, 6, 7, 8 kids. I mean, one of my best friends in school came from a family with 7 kids. My best friend, Don, there were 5 kids in his family. I mean, at least 4. 4 wasn't much at all. But that's what we had. So I was jealous of these kids that came from 7 and 8 kid families. And so I think that's why I invented extra brothers and sisters to sort of impress the other kids that I came from, you know, a big family too. So that was third grade. On into fourth grade. I don't remember fourth grade other than the fact that I think I had the measles that year. Maybe, maybe not. We also had a very, very pretty teacher. Her name was Sister Rose. She's very young, and she looked like everything was weirding her out, and probably because she had a class with me in it. And also, I think all the kids in our class that year, 1952, a lot of weird kids were born. And so she had to deal with all of that. On into the sixth grade, and that was the year that we had Mrs. Peck. She was our teacher, and I turned 11. And we were given a homework assignment, which was to do a report on one of the planets. And I picked Venus, and I did such a lousy job. I wasn't really all that interested. I could give a flying F about Venus or anything else. But I went ahead and I wrote this stupid report, realizing that I was probably going to get an F. And on that day, we were supposed to give a oral dissertation. In other words, stand up in front of the class and talk about, I'm Philip Hendry, and this is about Venus, the planet. In any way, it was invented. I mean, it wasn't invented, but God created it or something, you know. So that's what I'm supposed to do. Well, just before I was going to get up there to give that, because my classmate, a young lady by the name of Lulu, that's who we knew her, name was Lucille, she was doing a report, and a really good one, unlike Saturn or Jupiter or something. And as she was doing that, and just before I knew I had to get up there and face the music on my shitty Venus report, the teacher comes over the PA, Sister Rosalia, and says, kids, your attention, please. President Kennedy has been shot in Dallas. We just got news that President Kennedy just got his head blowed off. No, she didn't say that. I'm sorry. I should have said that. President Kennedy got shot. And I was like shocked. And just so you know, my immediate thought was not, boy, that sure saved my ass with that Venus report. No, my immediate thought was, wow, that's pretty weird. But isn't that what happens to these world leaders? Because you have to understand, even at that age, I was aware of the fact that there was violence in the world. There were world leaders being assassinated all the time. A guy by the name of Ben Bella, who was the head of Algiers, I think, was assassinated by French special forces or something. There was always violence, especially in Africa. There were assassinations going on. So when I heard that President Kennedy had been shot, my first thought was, that's pretty bad, but that's what happens, right? World leaders get shot. So I wasn't stunned and shocked as one might think. Obviously, the adults in my world were. They were the same way I was after 9/11, the same way we all were after 9/11. I was like my stepkids were after 9/11. They only knew, hey, we don't have to go to school today. And that's pretty much what happened after the word came down that Kennedy was assassinated. The word then came down that kids, we've called your parents to come and get you. So, you know, we're having half day, so get your ass out of here. And, well, she didn't say that, but said, you know, your parents will come and get your ass and have a nice, you know, have a nice life. So that's what I recall about that day, being like, okay, we got to go home because this heavy shit happened. And my report on Venus, I don't think I was ever asked to give that report on Venus. Mrs. Peck, who was our teacher, had this stunned look on her face, as every adult did. That day we went home. My father was home. He'd already gotten home, and he was fielding calls from the salesman that worked for him, asking, did we have to go to work on Monday? Asking my dad. President Johnson had declared Monday as a national day of mourning, and my father, I remember yelling at a couple of these guys saying, don't you hear what the president just said? It's a day of mourning. No, there's no goddamn, you know. So he's kind of pissed off at them. And hence the 24-hour, what we call today the 24-hour news cycle, and we take that for granted. It was unknown in those days, but it commenced on that day. It was wall-to-wall news coverage. It was never-ending television news about Kennedy, about what happened in Dallas, about the Dallas police, the body being transported back to D.C., the planned funeral, interviews that they had on tape with the president, interviews they had on tape with Mrs. Kennedy, what the president was supposed to say at his speech and never that he never gave. They went to the trademark. They showed all the people there. They had to disperse the people because there wasn't. It was a hell of a day. And on top of that, the number one album in the country, the number one comedy album in the country on that day, was a comedy album by Von Meter, I think his name was. He was a comedian who did a John Kennedy impression, and it was called The First Family, and it was a rather amusing, I guess, album featuring comedic turns by the actors on this album playing their various parts, playing John Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, Carolyn Kennedy, Bobby, all of them, and it was a very popular album, and I remember my sister sitting and listening to it, looking rather melancholy. I don't think she was crying, but she was looking very sad, listening to this comedy album, and me listening to it and also thinking, probably for the first time, getting the import of what happened that day. I remember thinking, wow, President Kennedy's gone, so we can't really laugh anymore. This was funny, you know, and he's gone. That was about as heavy as it got for me. And then the evening wound up on into a day. And the next day, I remember watching. I didn't see it live. Some of the networks carried it live, but we happened to be watching one that had not carried Oswald being transported from the jail to the paddy wagon where they were going to take him to a more secure location, I guess. But that's when Ruby came out of the crowd and shot him. I saw it on tape, and I immediately remarked to my parents, you know, what had happened, and they came in. That was the second time I'd seen something on TV that they hadn't seen. This time they believed me. The first time I saw something on TV that they didn't believe I had seen was a year before. I was a little 10-year-old, and news came over that Marilyn Monroe had been found dead. And I went in and told my parents, and they all, stop it. You're kidding. I said, no, it's on the news. Marilyn Monroe is dead. So when I came in, I said that Oswald just got shot. They believed me. So it took Marilyn Monroe and Lee Harvey Oswald for my parents to finally go, you know, this kid, Phil, I know he's full of shit half the time with these gags, but maybe he's telling the truth. So that was a very interesting period of my life. From that point forward, the world was different. The Dodgers had won the pennant that year. They beat the Yankees in four in the World Series. My Uncle George came out from Canada. Our cousins had come to visit, in fact. And that was a lot of fun. I'd gone fishing, deep sea fishing, for the first time in my life that previous summer, just before I turned 11, with a friend and some other friends. And we had such a great time and came home. And that was really the last really great summer. Then comes the Kennedy assassination. And then a whole other thing starts happening. And I guess maybe we all started getting older, because here come the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show that year. I was 11 years old, going on 12. And suddenly music became really, really important to me. And the radio. Suddenly, that became super important to me. Up to that point, you know, I liked listening to the radio, but I never really took it seriously as an art form or something that I was fascinated by, like I did post-Beatles on into my 7th and 8th grade years and my teenage years, as the result of that year, the Kennedy assassination, and then everything getting real fucking serious, and then here come the Beatles, and a really great summer awaited that summer with all of that great music. And, you know, all of a sudden girls don't look all that weird. And there are other things in life that are interesting you besides your own family and your own immediate world. And my family was really starting to suffer. My father was cheating on my mother, and they were arguing a lot, and our family was starting to fall apart the summer of 1964. I hate to leave this story on such a bummer, but really, that's kind of, that's the lead up. That's the biography of Phil Henry leading into my teenage years. So what I'll do is this time next week, next Monday, I'll pick it up. The summer of 1964, Little Anthony and the Imperials, the Rolling Stones. My mom was chaperoning a house full of teenage girls at Newport Beach. And guess who got to come along because we were too young to watch ourselves? My kid sister and me. So, you know, that again was one of the reasons why I became pretty intensely interested in girls, even though I hadn't yet turned 12.
Yeah.
This is Phil Henry, executive produced by Phil Henry for Siempre Incorporated, all rights reserved on Podcast One.